Well, good to have you here tonight. As you know, on Thursday night, any question you want to ask about the Bible, and no question is off the table. And we're here for you to be able to just open up and maybe something you studied, something you went through in the Bible you wasn't sure of, or maybe you got in a discussion with somebody and need some help figuring it out. Doesn't matter. We're here to help you. And we operate here in just a moment. If you got a question, you can raise your hand. I'll call upon you, and then we'll throw the question out. We'll kick it around and talk about it, and we'll go from there. I want to welcome all of our YouTube people on from around the world tonight, and thank you for being part of us. If you have a question, and you can fire it into our YouTube guru up there, and Mr. Aaron, and he will get it down to me, and we'll get it from here. So good to have you here tonight. I have a question here that I'm going to deal with first that that was given to me tonight, and this guy came all the way over here tonight to ask this question, so I want to make sure that I get it. Dwayne, I read this here now. Let me make sure. Raise your hand, Dwayne, so we get the mic over to you here. Who's got the mic? Right here. Yeah, okay. So in case he needs to say something to me here, I can talk to him.
I have to hear him.
Okay, I got this here, and let me see if I understand what you're asking. You got two parts of your question here.
Right.
The first part is, when Jesus went back to heaven, does now Jesus, the Holy Spirit, and God completely understand what we are as humans?
Yeah, how tough it is for us to live as humans, because I kind of believe I might be a million miles off and I'm on dangerous ground. But I think in the Old Testament that God didn't know how it was experimentally to live among men down there like we live. He knew, he just hadn't experienced it and didn't know from that point of view. But after Jesus came here and lived among us and died, and then communicating with God, of course, then God, the Godhead all knew then because Jesus had experienced it.
Okay. Your question is a very good question, and you're really not a million miles off, about 15 miles, probably all you're off.
I have one other conclusion, too, in
yeah,
a little
ahead.
Bit.
No, go ahead. I want to hear that. Yeah,
okay. The conclusion is, to me, is that God now in the New Testament has greater compassion, greater patience with us sinners, and maybe even more mercy. And I believe that possibly because when's the last time he opened up earth and swallowed people like he did in the Old Testament? If that's the case, San Francisco will be gone now.
You haven't been to Raytown lately, have you? I couldn't pass that out. Well, your question is great. I'm going to try to put it into, I think the only problem, and a lot of what you're saying is true. I think your perspective is, I can help you with your perspective on it.
Great. I need all the help I can get.
Well, no, you're a good guy, buddy, and there's no problem with that. Now, let me address this in the part that you went. Just talk about, you mentioned that, and I understand where you're coming from this, and it looks like this. It really does. You would think that when Jesus was here and walked among men, and the Holy Spirit, that when he went back to heaven, that he would have a better appreciation and understanding of what we go through because he was here with us.
You see? Exactly.
Yes, but the reality of that is that not exactly the same way, but in much the same way, God and Jesus did the same thing in the Old Testament, just not as the New Testament structure, because you have turn over to Psalms 78 here. Because remember now, in Genesis chapter 6, it's the most wicked time the world has ever seen, which is likened to the time we have now. But yet, within that, we find in Genesis 5, that Enoch walked with God for 300 years. So there had to be some kind of understanding of what he went through and what he went through. God himself looked down in Genesis 6 and said, it's repented me that I've made man, because all his ways are continually evil. So he knew where man was at, even though it wasn't in the New Testament sense like that we did. Psalm 78 is an incredible insight into what he's asking here. We talked about this just the other week in Sunday morning.
But did he know experimentally at that point?
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by experimentally.
Well, I can come up to you and you can tell me, oh, I've had a bad day today. I was in a wreck and my uncle died and all that. And I can say, oh, that was a bad day. But my uncle's never died. How can I know experimentally? I can pretend I do or say I do, but I'm not experiencing what you've experienced.
Well, yeah, but that's because you're a human being and you can't transcend over into that other person's world where God can, through the Holy Spirit of God, and can understand. You know, you find so many times that he understood. In fact, Psalm 78 is where I want to go. Let me read it here for you. It says in verse 36. Make sure I got the right chapter here. Yeah, 78:36. Nevertheless, they did flatter him with their mouth, this is Israel now, and lied unto him with their tongues, for their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast in his covenant. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and destroyed them not. Yea, many a time turned he his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath. Verse 39, for he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes away and cometh not again. And so every time, look at verse 42, they remembered not his hand, nor the day when he delivered them from their enemies. On and on down through here, through the whole Old Testament, dealing with the nation of Israel, you find that God directly understands what they're going through. Here's a place where if he was the hardline God that we would imagine him to be in the Old Testament, and as Dwayne said, he's opened up the ground, which he did, and swallowed thousands of people, which he did. But he doesn't do that with the nation of Israel. Once they get into the land, he deals with them totally differently. And now we find in Exodus chapter 4, before they come out of Egypt, that God calls the nation of Israel his son. Now, that nation is to God as a son, just as I am to Christ as his son. And the relationship between God and Israel and me and Christ are paralleled, even though one is a nation under the kingdom of heaven, the other one is a individual under the kingdom of God. God's compassion for them, as you see in Psalm 78, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I could take you places all the way through the Old Testament that showed God should have killed them and should have wiped them out, but did not, because here it is, he understood that they were just flesh. And he understands what they're going through, and that's what holds back his not giving his full wrath or all his wrath. So it looks like from the Old Testament versus the New Testament that Christ would have come down here, and because he walked around men, that he would have understood it, and you would think of that because, you know, he was physically here. But you don't want to lose sight of the fact that all through the Old Testament, God was spiritually here. And he was walking with men, Enoch, for 300 years. Noah walked with God. Jacob, Isaac, the list is almost endless. David, that he had an intimate relationship and understood what they were going through, but he didn't have the same kind of relationship that he has with us because he lives in us and seals us. He didn't do that in the Old Testament, but he certainly, on both levels, understands everything that they're going through because he's here just as he is in the New Testament, but just not the same way. But it's a thing where he definitely, from Psalm 78, he understands. He understands that they're flesh, that they struggle. And, you know, it's a thing where you see his compassion to the nation of Israel all through the Old Testament, when he should have, in the book of Judges, I don't know how many times they turn their back on him, but he keeps sending them a deliverer. And all through the 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, when they're about as far from God as they can be, God still sends them prophets. And those prophets are trying to get them to come back to God. So he does in the Old Testament as a nation with them what he does in the New Testament through a church as individuals. Some of God's people get way out there as an individual, just like the nation of Israel did as a nation. What does God do? God sends you preachers. God sends you evangelists. God gives you a church. God gives you people who will hold you accountable with the Word of God and give you the very words of God in the New Testament sense, just like God did. There is not a whole lot of difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament other than the two kingdoms that represent each one. The one is a physical kingdom, kingdom of heaven, that deals with a nation, which is God's Son, as a corporate nation. The other one is the kingdom of God. It's a spiritual kingdom where God deals with us as individuals. But he, in both cases, if you go to the scriptures, he understands and he has compassion, as it says right there. He had compassion on them. But he being not just compassionate, full of compassion. And you'll find that over and over again in the Old Testament. So it's the same, but it doesn't operate the same way. But God's compassion is all the way through the Old Testament. Now, the second part of your question there is it seems that God deals more harshly in the Old Testament than he does in the New Testament. And one of the answers to that is the fact that they're under the law. So the law is a very tight, no wiggle room when it comes to doing what God says. In the New Testament, it's grace. If God would enact the Old Testament law in the New Testament times, we'd all be dead. But he doesn't do that because one is under the law and one is under grace. Now, why is that? Because in the Old Testament, again, he's dealing with nations. He's not dealing with individuals. He will use individuals to deal with his nation, but he's dealing with a nation. God's plan to reach the world of the Old Testament was a nation. That nation had to be under law. And the law that God gave them, we know it as the Ten Commandments, but actually it's all the book of Exodus and Leviticus, and it could fill volumes on what God told them to do. And it's very strict and it's very stringent. And there's not a lot of room there to maneuver like we have under the New Testament. So when you look at it from that standpoint, yes, it looks like it is. But then when you go back and you look that God compensated man under the law, because he knew how strict it was, so he allowed things and gave him things under the law that we don't have under grace. One of the things under the law is if you followed the law and you did what was right and you followed God, you could claim God to make you rich, and God would have to give you riches. That's why the apostles over there in Matthew, when Jesus said it's harder for a rich man, you know, to go to heaven than a camel to go through an eye of a needle, the apostles looked at themselves and said, well, then who can be saved? Because in the Old Testament scenario, riches was proof of your godliness. Job, Abraham, all of those guys. So he balances it out, and he allows them to get things more materialistically under the law to make up for the stringent of the law that they don't have under grace. And, of course, another thing is, in the Old Testament, if you did what's right, you see this example with David. You can claim God to wipe out your enemies or kill your enemies, and God would do that. And, of course, you can't do that under the New Testament. You'll find that God understood in the Old Testament there was a under the law, there was no sacrifice for somebody committing adultery. And so the only penalty for it was with death. God understood, here is compassion, he understood man's human desire. He understood the fact that he was flesh and the passions, the desires that he had. So what did God do? God allowed them to have concubines or have more than one wife, even though in the law he said that's not the best thing you do. He didn't come down and whack anybody that did it because he understood the stress of being under a situation that would produce something like that. So he made a provision for it, even though, and this is where, you know, you can get into the permissive will of God versus direct will of God. But he allowed that, even though the principle was clear, it was a situation where he allowed that because he knew what the law, how tight it was and how stringent it was, and the fact that he had to. So it gives and goes on both sides. And when you begin to look at the law and realize that the reason why he had to have a system of laws is because he's dealing with a nation. We don't need a system of laws because we're dealing with individuals. So he gives us a book full of principles. Now, I'm not saying that the Ten Commandments don't have something for us. But, you know, again, the Ten Commandments back in Exodus chapter 20 when they were given, the Ten Commandments were never given by God for anybody to keep. They were given by God to show you and me how far we fell short of what God expected. So when you put the whole thing together, it may look that way, but God, being a righteous God and a loving God and an understanding God, both Old Testament and New Testament, balances it out so that at the end of the day, everything comes out pretty much on an even keel. It may look like they had a tougher time than what we've got, but when you put it all on the table and you look at it, it pretty much evens itself out because there were some things that he did for them that he did not do for us. And some of those things were, and it goes back to that nation. That's why under the Old Testament law, if you had rebellious kids, if they didn't get it right, you killed them. I mean, you can't do that today. I know you'd like to sometimes, but you can't do that today. But why was that? Because he knew that rebellious kids would destroy a nation, and therefore they would destroy the vehicle by which he's going to reach the world through Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. So you got to look at it as it lays itself out, as one is a nation that is God's son corporately, one is an individual that is God's son as an individual. And God's dealing with both of them the same way in as far as his grace and as far as his compassion. But you got to take into consideration one is a physical kingdom dealing with a nation and one is a spiritual kingdom dealing with individuals. And there lies the difference between the two.
That was eye-opening to me when you showed me in Psalm 78 too. It clearly says there that he knew. And I guess the one thing I have to go back to, God is God, and he can see things any way he wants to.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's got that power.
Yeah,
number two, you mentioned about the New Testament, folks. They're not getting by with anything. A white throne judgment is just a little further away before they get what's coming to them, the lost people.
Yeah, and you got to remember, at the end of the day, both face a judgment. The nation of Israel faces the tribulation, which is their judgment, and we face the judgment seat of Christ, which is, if you really understood it, you'd probably rather go through the tribulation.
Hmm.
But it's a thing where both of us face a judgment. Everybody does. The angels get judged, 2 Corinthians 6. 1 Corinthians 6. The unsaved people get judged, Revelation chapter 20. We get judged, Revelation 3, or 1 Corinthians 3, 2 Corinthians 5. And the nation of Israel gets judged in the tribulation period.
Hmm.
Everybody has their judgment, and that's where God evens it all out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you cleared it up real good. I appreciate that. And it all fits good.
No problem. No problem. Next question. Alex, you're closer to him. Then we'll come around the backside to Marion.
Can we go to Deuteronomy 29? And can we read verses 10 through 13?
29, 10 through 13. Okay. Ye stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders, and your officers, with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy strangers that is in thy camp, from the ewer of thy wood to the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into the covenant with the Lord thy God, and into his oath which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, and as he hath said unto thee, and he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.
So, I mean, he's talking about them making God like their God, but why does he reference himself in verse 13 as a God and not the God?
That he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he said unto thee, and as he said before unto the Father. Amen. It's a thing where, if you know the history, this is a chapter 29, is right before they go over into the land. And, you know, this is a, what you have here in 29 is really a continuation of 28, where he's talking about the cursings and the blessings that will happen to Israel, the blessings if they do what's right, the cursings if they don't do what's right. And, of course, what you have here is that Israel has had all kinds of problems with gods. And it's a situation where they go all the way back to the golden calf. They've had the fiery serpent. Every problem that they've had, their main problem is they're going after the other gods. And so when he's saying in verse 13, he's telling him and he's admonishing them what they have to do to stay in God's covenant that he made with Abraham, and says in 13 that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, that he may be unto thee a God. And of course, he's talking in the sense of all the other gods that they have had coming up through the last 40 years. And he's just making a reference to them that he needs to be a God to them. Now, obviously, when you come on down through here, he says in verse 15, but to him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord, our God. So, you know, it's a thing where he's using the different words before the word God to make his point that Israel, you know, has had all kinds of God. They need a God, but they need our God. They need the God. You see the same thing over here. Come back to Exodus chapter 12. You see a similar thing here. Exodus chapter 12, verse 1. Now, this is right where God establishes the Passover for them when they came out of Egypt. And it says that the Lord spake unto Moses, verse 1, and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months, and it shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak you unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the tenth month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. Then he says, verse 4, and if the house will be too small for the lamb, now it's not a lamb anymore, it's the lamb, his neighbor next unto his house take according to the number of the souls, every man according to his eating. Verse 5, your lamb shall be without blemish. So you see, he uses a lamb, the lamb, and your lamb to show you something. And this is what he's doing back here. The first thing, and this is a great sermon if you ever want to do a devotion on it. The first thing that Israel needed, verse 3, was a lamb. And that's what every man and woman on this world needs. Just like they need a God, they needed a lamb. But not just any lamb will do. It has to be the lamb, see? And you can have a lamb, and you can even have the right lamb, the lamb, but until you make it, verse 5, your lamb, you ain't going nowhere. So that's how he uses those words. And in Deuteronomy, he's doing basically this, not exactly the same thing here, but he's making an analogy here that, that they're if they're going to stand before God, they need to have a God. But it needs to be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they need to make that God their God. So he's just using the play on words like he did in Exodus chapter 12, but it's a thing because Israel's had all kinds of God's problems. And so he's making the point here that it has to be, they have to have a God, but it has to be their God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is what he's saying. Yeah, good question. Back to Mary and Man.
I have two passages to look at.
I'm sorry?
Two passages to look at.
Okay.
1 Samuel 6:18.
1 Samuel 6. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines, belonging to the five lords of the fenced cities and of the country and the villages, even under the great stone of Abel, whereon they sat down the ark of the Lord, which stone remaineth unto this day in the field of Joshua.
Okay, and the second passage is 2 Samuel 20, verse 16 through 19.
You say chapter 20?
Yes.
Okay, verses what?
16 through 19.
Okay. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies.
2 Samuel.
Oh, I'm sorry. You say verse 16?
Yes.
Okay. Then cried a wise woman out of the city, hear, hear, say, I pray you unto Joab, come near hither that I may speak with thee. And when he was come near to her, the woman said, art thou Joab? And he answered, I am he. Then she said unto him, hear the words of thine handmaid. And he answered, I do hear.
Verse 18 and 19 as well.
Okay. Then she spake, saying, they were wont to speak in old times, saying, they shall surely ask counsel at Abel. And so they ended the matter. I am one of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel, that seekest to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?
Okay, so as I was coming through 2 Samuel, it mentions the counsel at Abel. And it also mentions that the woman is wise. I did the study on Abel, and I found out that Abel is kind of a city or an area. And the Philistines in 1 Samuel 6 was trying to give the ark back or get rid of the ark, and they laid it on this great stone in Abel. Does the woman, does her wisdom come from the rock or come from the ark that was set on the rock? How does that all tie together, or does
it
at all?
Well, I don't, I don't know. I don't know that the reference here in 1 Samuel 18 is to the city. It says the stone of Abel. I would say, probably, of course, you can't prove this, but based on the consistency of everything, I would say this is the place where Abel offered his sacrifice in Genesis chapter 4. And you are right that this is where they put the ark down to rest when they were. Now, here, this stone of Abel, it's a picture of the stone would be Christ. Or the ark resting on that stone, it would be a picture of us getting the grace of God and the rest that we have in God by the ark that is a type of Christ resting on a stone, which is a type of God, and that showing the two together. Now, that's the picture that you would have, as the inspirational application. Well, she's making a reference back here in 20, where it says 18, Shirley asked counsel at Abel, so they ended the matter. That may be a reference to that back there, or it may be a reference to some other matter that was settled there that isn't recorded in the Bible. You don't know for sure. But it's not a reference to the city. It's more of a reference to the stone back there is where the ark was rested on it. But you don't know that here in 20 if that's exactly the same point. There's places in the Bible where they'll make a reference to something that somebody did that you don't find recorded for you in the Scriptures. I mean, obviously the Stone of Abel was more used than just this one time back here because of what it represented. Obviously they knew what it represented. So it was a rallying place to deal with problems and solve matters, evidently based on the fact that that's where Abel brought his sacrifice back in Genesis 4.
So you can't point her wisdom goes back to the great stone at Abel?
Yes. I would say, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I wanted.
No problem.
Okay, in Institute 2 weeks ago, you mentioned the seven.
Honey?
Back in Institute, like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, Institute, okay.
You had mentioned there were seven trumpets. Can you go through those?
Seven what?
Trumpets.
Trumpets?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Come back here in Revelation. The reason why some people get messed up on the rapture of the church, as far as you got guys who teach that the church is going to go through the first half of the tribulation and then they're raptured out. Then you have guys who believe you're going to go through the whole tribulation and are raptured out. And, of course, they get confused on the trumpets. The Bible talks about in 1 Thessalonians 4 and 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it talks about the last trump. And Revelation 4, which is a picture of the rapture, it says, I heard a voice as a trumpet. And, so then when they get into Revelation, they start to see another set of trumpets. And they make the determination that the trumpets are the same. And, of course, they're not. And when you come through the book of Revelation, and I've told you this before, and I'll break it down for you here in a second. When you come through the book of Revelation, you're going to have, once you get past Revelation chapter 5, you're going to have four distinct accounts of the last half of the tribulation period with an emphasis each time on something else, but each one coming to a picture of the second coming four times. And I've told you many, many times the reason why you have four accounts of the second coming is because the Bible's consistent. And in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you have four accounts of the first coming. So you got to have it worked out that way. So when you get into Revelation chapter 5, and the rapture takes place in 4. In chapter 5, you have the beginning of the first time through. And the first time through here, he opens up seven seals. And that'll run chapter, we'll give it 5, 6, and 7. Then in chapter 8, after he opens the seventh seal, we start the second time through the last half of the tribulation period. And now we have the seven trumpets. And if you come through here, it runs all the way up to chapter 11. And you'll have within there seven trumpets. And when they sound, it opens up another judgment. So the seven trumpets are found in chapter 8 of Revelation up to chapter 11. And he blows these trumpets, and when the trumpets sound, then something, another part of the tribulation. And most people teach the book of Revelation as, they teach it that, they see the seven trumpets, they see the seven seals, seven trumpets, and they think that the seven seals happen first, then the seven trumpets happen, and then the next thing happen, and the next thing happen. That's not how it's working. All these things are happening at the same time in the last 3.5 years. It's just that the Bible is so consistent that it gives you four accounts of the second coming, and each one focuses on a different aspect. The first one was the seals, here at the trumpets. And, it's a thing where the seventh trumpet and angel is found in verse 7 of chapter 10. So you find that once you get to that one, and then in chapter 12, you start the third time through, and the third time through will run chapter 12, chapter 13 and 14. And here, he puts the emphasis on the tribulation, the Antichrist, the devil. And in chapter 12 and 13, you have recorded for you the two greatest chapters in the New Testament on the devil and the Antichrist and how they're connected. Chapter 12 shows you the devil up in heaven and he's persecuting the nation of Israel. Then at the end of chapter 12, it tells you, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth, for the devil himself has come down. And in chapter 13:1, the beast, the Antichrist, shows up. And so he's kicked out of heaven bodily, and he shows up on this earth. And that'll be the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. And that runs through 12, 13, and 14, and all deals with the devil. And I've told you before that the two greatest chapters in the Old Testament on the devil and the Antichrist is Job chapter 40 and 41. When you get those two chapters and then these two chapters and you lay them out together, you get quite a bit of information on it. And now the fourth time through will be 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. And the fourth time through will be the seven vials. And this will also deal with the destruction of Babylon the Great. And then in chapter 19, you have the second coming of Christ. Then it moves right into chapter 20 with a millennium. Then it moves right into chapter 21 with the new heavens and the new earth in Jerusalem. Then it moves right into 22 into eternity. So if you want a workable breakdown of the book of Revelation, here's what you got. You got Revelation 1, 2, and 3 is the church age. Revelation chapter 4, a door opens up, and a voice in heaven says, come up hither. And I think in the first three chapters, you find the word church 19 times. Once the door opens in heaven, you never find the word church again in the book of Revelation. He's taken out. And then we move into chapter 5 and 6, and 5, 6, and 7 will be your first time through. And on here, as I told you, you're dealing with the seals. And then 8, 9, and 10, and 11, it brings you through the second time, and that will be the trumpets that you have. And that's where your seven trumpets are found. So seven trumpets blow. Trumpets in the Bible always signal the Israel for the gathering together. In the Bible, they also signal a time of judgment. And so there's a trumpet for the second coming, seven of them in the book of Revelation. And then there's a trumpet for the rapture of the church for the judgment of the seat of Christ. So then you have the third time through, chapter 12, 13, and 14, and that will be on the devil and all that stuff that I gave you. And then you have your fourth time through, which will be 15, 16, 17, and 18, and that will be the seven vials and also deal with the destruction of Babylon the Great. Then you have the final account of the second coming in 19, chapter 19, so we can put 19 in here too. That's the final account, so it would run 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. 1911 is the second coming. And then just moving right along in the events, after the second coming, chapter 20 is the millennium. After the millennium, chapter 21 is the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem. After 21, then you have eternity. And then that ends the book. So that's the basic, simple, biblical breakdown of the book of Revelation. And if you study it that way and put those four accounts of the second coming of Christ, understanding that they're not consecutive, they're concurrent. They're all happening at the same time in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. But that's where your seven trumpets are, dear. That help you? Good. Any next? Oh, we got one back here on the internet.
John chapter 20.
John chapter 20?
Yeah. John
okay.
chapter 20, two verses, verse 19, and also verse 26.
All right, 20:19, we'll read that one first. Then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for the fear of the Jews, then Jesus came and stood in the midst and saith unto them, peace be unto you. The other one is 26?
Yeah.
And after 8 days, again, his disciples were within, and Thomas with them, and came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, peace be unto you.
Is there any relevance to the doors being shut? It says it twice, and it just kind of calls it out, and I don't know why.
Well, I think it tells you very clearly, if you just read 19, then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for the fear of the Jews. They're afraid the Jews are going to find out that they're there or whatever they're doing.
I didn't know if it had anything doctrinally applied to the doors being shut.
Yeah, if it is, I don't know what it would be. I've never seen it. From all everything that you know, it says there, it's a pretty well unfolding story of you know of just him showing up to them. So if there's something doctrinal there, I never saw it. So I don't know. I don't think so. But what do I know?
Thank you.
I do know that from the position that the doors were shut because they were afraid. You know, they don't want the Jews to find out. There was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of fear after he died. The kind of like the Jews' world fell apart. The disciples' world fell apart, I'm sorry. You know, they were expecting this great triumphal king. And everything kind of went to pieces on the cross. They didn't understand what he was saying all the time. And so they're kind of, everything is up in the air at this point. For 3 years, 3.5 years, he did everything for them. He made every decision. He told them where they were going. He told them what to do. Now suddenly, he's not there anymore, so they don't know what to do. So they're caught in the limbo of all this that's going on here, and they're afraid. You know, they all scattered when they come and took him, and now they're back together, but they're really antsy because they're not sure what's going to happen. They could have been arrested at any moment. They themselves could be killed, crucified, for being his followers. There was enough people around that did not like Christ and were looking to associate all the people that were with him, that it could be a very, if they were found out that they were the 12 that were with him, it would not be a very good deal. So they're afraid. So they're kind of hiding out in this room up here when he appears to them. Now, doctrinally, you know, I don't see anything there. I mean, I'm saying there's not. I'm just saying I don't see it. I've never read anybody that did see it either. So probably doesn't help you much, but at least you know why they had the door shut. Miss Jenny.
In your message on Sunday, you were talking a lot about deacons and just like the elders in the church. Over here in 1 Timothy 3, it mentions that the deacons and bishops.
1 Timothy 3?
Yes.
Okay.
It says in 3:12.
Where do we get there? Okay. 1 Timothy chapter 3. What verse?
12.
Okay. Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well.
So in order for someone to be a deacon, is he saying you must be married and you must have children?
Well, that's what's usually taught. I grew up in the system that they kind of tore these verses every which way to make it whatever they wanted to say. If you look here at chapter 3, verse 2, it's talking about a pastor. And, you know, the qualifications for a pastor and a deacon are pretty almost down the line together. And it says here that a bishop must be a blameless, the husband of one wife. And then over in 12, it says, let the deacons be the husband of one wife. Now, all my life growing up in churches, this was always used that if you were ever divorced, you couldn't be a pastor or a deacon because from the Bible standpoint, you were the husband of more than one wife. And, you know, that ridiculous idea was permeated all down through Christianity. I mean, the mainline Baptist churches back in my day in the 70s, that they and I never really, I mean, I was young back then, and I didn't have my credibility. I had to shoot my mouth off about anything. But, you know, my favorite class in school was English. And I look back on it now, and I see where God had used that and planned that because he was going to give me an English Bible that it was based on English structure of the English language. In English, for me, I don't know how it is today, but English class was broken down in two sections. You had your English grammar, and then you had English comprehension. And English comprehension was where you read a story, and then you comprehended the story. You remembered the story. You looked for the key things to remember the story. I was great at English comprehension because I liked to read. I liked to read. And I was, you know, I was the most hated guy in the English class because every time she would give us a story and she would say, who wants to tell the story? I'd raise my hand and tell the story. Nobody else would get it. Nobody else wanted to. And it was the thing where I look back on that now, and I cannot tell you how that has paid off for me with the Bible. But also the English structure of English grammar. And I've never understood how a Baptist pastor who is supposed to be educated and intelligent could ever be so stupid as to read verse 2 or verse 12. And I want to say this before I get into her question here. Because the English grammar of verse 2, it says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. In English grammar, that's present tense. That's not past tense. That's present tense. When you get over in verse 12, it says the same thing. That little word be, let the deacons be the husband, that is present tense in English grammar. I'm sorry. You want to throw it back to a guy that's been divorced, you know, at some point in his life, that's fine. But you can't prove it by that verse because the English structure of the English language, which the King James translators were perfect on, coagulated the verses in the right structure of the English grammar, and the word be puts it into a present tense, meaning that he could not be married to more than one wife at the time. Polygamy is what it's dealing with. And so, you know, all of this stuff fits into the structure. Now, Jenny's question here, it says, let the deacons be the husband of one wife, ruling their children and their own house as well. And her question is, does that mean that a deacon has to be married and has to have children? It's not, well, the answer to that is, it's not saying that he has to, but it is saying that if he is married, he has to be the husband of one wife and has to rule his children well. But you can't conclude from that that if he is single and he meets the qualifications are that you can only be married to one woman at the same time. And if you have kids, you have to have them under your rule. That's the qualification. But it says nothing about the fact that you have to be married. It doesn't say have to be. It says let the deacons be. If you're going to be a deacon and you're married, it has to be one wife. And if you have kids, which you probably would if you're married, you have to have them under rule. Now, there are churches that, and I'll just throw it out there. There are churches out there that would take that position. I'm not saying that's Jenny's position. She's asking the question. But there are churches that would take the position that says that, you know, a deacon, you know, has to be married to be a deacon. There are places that says that a pastor has to be married to be a pastor. I think it's a good thing if he is. But here again, in chapter 3, verse 2, there's no disqualifying if he's not. It's just simply stating the fact that he must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach. So these are the qualifications, and it's not limiting him if he isn't. I think he, with what a pastor has to deal with and what he has to get into, I think it's good for him to be. But I've known guys that had lost their wives. Their wives died. They continued on and pastored. Same way with deacons. We have deacons in our church who are young guys or who are exemplary in every way, shape, or form, but they're not married. And I don't take that position. Because I don't think you can make that a doctrinal position. Now, if a church arbitrarily said, well, that's what we want to follow, hey, I have no problem with it. You run your church any way you want to. But you can't prove it on that passage. It has to be a preference because I want my deacons married. I have no problem with that. You know, as long as they're married to a woman, I have no problem with that. You know, that's fine. That's your preference if you want to do that. But that is a preference. It's not necessarily a doctrine because it never states in here that you can't not be. It just says that if you are, that you have to be married to one woman. That's a qualification. You got to remember at the time that this stuff was being written, and Timothy was written around, you know, around Paul, by Paul when he was in jail in those areas. Polygamy was a major issue in not only Christianity but the world. So you got to put it in the context of what they're dealing with, and it works good for us as long as you understand how it all plays itself out. So I would say that, you know, there's no place definitive in the Bible that it says a pastor or a deacon has to be married to be that office. And those are the only two offices in the church, but it's never given as a commandment or condition for that office. But it is given that if you are a deacon and you are married, that it has to be one wife, and if you have children, they have to be under subjection. And here again, if a church wanted to take that position for whatever reason, I wouldn't argue with them. They can do whatever they want to do, but I think that you cannot go to that passage and prove it. Praise God. That help you? Okay.
Same chapter, 3:3 and 3:8.
Not given to wine nor striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous.
3:8.
Oh, I'm sorry. Likewise must the deacons be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, nor greedy of filthy lucre.
So how come bishops can have no wine, deacons can have a little wine?
Say that again now.
How come it says the bishops can have no wine, but the deacons can have a little wine? You know, stomach's ache, often infirmities.
Oh, not, okay, yeah, verse 3, not given to wine, and then the deacons can't. Well, obviously, you got two places that are explaining what he can and what he cannot do. We've been in Deuteronomy chapter 32 before, and we know that there's two types of wine. And we know that one is the fermented stuff, which is very clearly defined. The other one is grape juice, which is also clearly defined. So when you get into this chapter here, and he's talking in 3, not given to wine, he's talking about in the sense of drinking it outside the medical purposes that was allowed under 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 23. Because Paul tells Timothy to drink a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine often infirmities. Now that wine there that he tells Timothy isn't grape juice. It's fermented, but it's for medicinal purposes. In other words, drugs are illegal in the United States, but yet you can get drugs legally from your pharmacist if your doctor prescribes it. You can get, you know, Valium, you can get, you know, codeine, you can get all of the stuff that is highly addictive and stuff that if you bought it on the street would be illegal and you'd go to jail, but it's not illegal when it's used for medicinal purposes, when it's controlled as a medical thing, even though it's the exact same drugs that the guy on the street is buying because he's stoned on it and you're taking it because you're sick and you want to get stoned on it so you feel better. So wine is the same thing. Wine in itself, as in the bad sense, has no place in a bishop's world nor in a deacon's world. But he didn't say the same thing both places because he knew that if we read the whole thing and understood Deuteronomy chapter 32, we'd know what he was saying. A bishop, down here in verse 3, is not given the wine. Now, the not given the wine is, the way it's stated there, is clearly giving himself to it. You know, becoming a drunkard, not given to, giving himself to that. So that's in the bad sense. That would be also true of a deacon. But in a deacon's case, he says he limits it and says to much wine. In other words, we already know from the other places, 1 Timothy 5:23, as I gave you earlier, that that in a medicinal purpose or in a situation as a medical deal, that it's okay. Well, my dad was dying of cancer. He couldn't keep any weight on. He was about, I'd say, 200 pounds when he was in his prime. Wasn't heavy weight or anything. He was just a tall guy, and he carried the weight well. When he died, he was about 60 pounds, and the cancer had just eaten him to pieces. And before he went into the hospital the final time, and he was going to see the doctor back and forth, the doctor, and my dad never drank a lick in his life. He was a cigarette smoker, and that's what killed him, but he never drank. But the doctor told him and prescribed for him to drink 3 beers a day because of the calories, to try to get some weight on him. And, of course, my dad wouldn't do it. He didn't like the taste of it, and he never drank it. But I'm just saying, there are times when you have a situation that that it's okay. Now, obviously, that brings up the, you know, where in the next step to that is, what about the medical marijuana deal that's going on today? Now, you know, and the problem with that is the looseness of our society today. There'll be no rules or regulations. Man, you drive down Raytown, I found 9 places that are giving licenses for marijuana guys. I mean, it's a thing where when it becomes legal in that sense, everybody's going to run to their doctor and want to get it, and there's going to be guys out there who cares nothing about the legitimacy of it, who have the ability to write the prescriptions but don't have the code of ethics to govern it. And it's going to be an issue. You know, when we worked for a while with the military organization to help vets, the few, and it was a good organization, and I really liked it. But one of the problems was it was supposed to be Christian based, but it was only in terminology. And you know, as this thing approached, the leadership of it was pushing for the legalization of marijuana because so many of these veterans were struggling with post-traumatic stress and all those things that. You know, that they looked at that to help them. Now, listen to me. In a clinical medical scenario, if that's what the doctor says, then who am I to discredit that? But I want to tell you this. Jumping into the marijuana bed because you got post-traumatic stress or whatever your issues are without coming to Jesus first and getting into the Bible to try to fix it is a waste of time as far as I'm concerned. And you know what? Given a choice between somebody out there of spending the rest of their life in the Bible, the rest of their life smoking weed, what do you think they'll do? I know what I'd do. I'd stick with the book. But I'm telling you, that's where we're at today. And what the drugs will do is what alcohol does. It becomes the quick fix. And, of course, you know, the Bible legitimizes it in the sense, as Paul told Timothy, but at the same time, you're not giving yourself to it. And that's the difference between what he says to the pastor and he says to the deacon. Both go both ways. The pastor can drink a little wine if he has a stomach problem, but at the same time, the deacon can't be given to it just like the pastor can't. And it's one of those things that he uses 2 different phrases of it to teach the lesson to it, because both these guys have to follow the same set of rules that that fit together for each other, almost down the line together. So, yeah, it's a thing where it's a you know, it's a slippery slope, because it's a thing where most churches today. Baptist churches, anyhow, certainly the neo-evangelical crowd, they all give the green light for social drinking. You know, if you don't abuse it and you just do it socially, you know, then it's okay. And again, that is, to me, that is the most ridiculously asinine statement anybody could ever make. Whoever makes those kind of statements, whatever pastor, whoever you may be, whatever you do, whatever the bottom line is, you obviously know nothing about the flesh. Because you cannot tell your flesh you can have anything. And the more you tell your flesh it's okay, the more your flesh is going to, you're going to justify it. I never met an alcoholic in 50 years of ministry. I never met a guy who was an alcoholic that knew he was an alcoholic. They all know, they didn't know, but I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, you can't walk down the street in a straight line, but he's not an alcoholic. You don't give your flesh that kind of, and I'll tell you something else. If your church takes that position, how do you deal with somebody that comes into your church that is an alcoholic? Are you going to tell him he can, okay, just drink a little bit, and you think he's going to be able to handle that? The stupidity is just unbelievable today. I mean, it's just the, it's ridiculous. So the Bible sets down some clear rules for the leadership of the church, but also it's very clear in Deuteronomy chapter 32 for everybody that's a saved person. The two wines in the Bible. And it's a thing where, you know, the pastor is not to be given to it, neither is the deacon, but the deacon can drink a little wine for medicinal purposes, as so can the pastor. And he explains it by putting it in two different places where the qualifications are basically the same. And that's what you got. Yes, ma'am.
1 Corinthians chapter 11.
1 Corinthians chapter 11. Thinking of getting your hair cut, are you? 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Okay.
So the section of verses 3 through 16 when it's talking about the uncovering and covering of the hair and prayer and head and all that stuff, why is it, first of all, kind of what is it talking about through there, but then also why is it listed in the chapter that's talking about the ordinances given to the church?
Like, what now?
Like the ordinance of, like the last part of the chapter talks about the ordinance of Lord's Supper and communion, and in verse 2 it sets up that context that the ordinance are going to be given, but I don't really know where to fit verses 3 through 16, what it's talking about there.
Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the whole chapter up to verse 20, where he starts the dissertation of the Lord's Supper. But from verse 1 up to verse 19, we're dealing with an issue, and you remember now, you got to put chapter 11 in the context of the whole book of 1 Corinthians. You can't just take the chapter 11 and try to figure out what's going on here, because what's going on here is going on through the whole book. The church at Corinth, we know, is the most messed up church in all of the books of the New Testament. It's really got some issues. Corinth was a very worldly place. It was a very busy place that was a trade route, and it had obviously a lot of the worldly things had worked its way into this church, and they're completely off task here. And they are so messed up that Paul takes every chapter, and sometimes he's dealing with multiple issues in each chapter that they're dealing with. And in chapter 11, we're dealing with an authority issue that has popped up in his church with the women. And as he comes down through here, the first thing he does, which gives you the clue, is he says, "Be ye followers of me, even as I am, I also am of Christ." Then he says, "Now I praise you, brethren, that ye remember me in all things and keep the ordinances that I have delivered unto you. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." So in verse 3, He clearly lays out an authority structure that is missing in this church, and there's a breakdown of this. And the breakdown, obviously, is with the women in the church having a rebellious attitude or spirit toward the leadership of the church. So he first thing he does is he states the order of authority. The head of every man is Christ. The head of every woman is man. There's where the problem is in this church. And the head of Christ is God. Then he goes on and says, every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head. And of course, that's talking about somebody either praying or preaching or witnessing in the church with their head covered, would be a hat or whatever. But every woman that prayeth or prophesied with her head uncovered dishonoreth her head, which is her husband, for that is even all one as if she was shorn. For if the woman be not covered, let her also be shorn, but if she be ashamed for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. You know, what's happening here is that the women, in defiance of the man who is over them, authority of the church, are either cutting their hair or shaving their hair when their hair was given to them for covering. Now, this is not a thing where, and you get this all the time, you know, you got women today who have long hair, you have some women who have short hair. So it's easy if you would read this that you would come away with that and think that, you know, that all Christian women should have long hair because of the chapter. That's not what it's talking about. The hair is not the issue. It's the attitude against the authority of why they're cutting their hair that is the problem, not the length of their hair. And so they come down here, and it says in verse 7, for a man indeed ought not to cover his head, inasmuch as he is the image and the glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. So she covers her head, or her hair is her covering. Her hair is a picture of her submissiveness. If you go back into the Song of Solomon and you see the woman that he describes as a picture of the church, you can see that the submissiveness is in her hair. Her eyes are the eyes of a dove. That's like Christ's eyes are the eyes of a dove. And the Bible says that her eyes, she looks through her hair, her submissiveness. This is the breakdown in the church at Corinth. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Boy, guys like that verse, but that's not what you're talking about, guys. It's talking about in the context here. Neither was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Now, that's an incredible verse right there. Now, most people don't know what this, how to do with this verse, and boy, you ought to read some of the commentaries on it, and the smarter and the more degrees you get, the lesser you can figure out about it. But it's so simple. Once you understand that the problem here in the church of Corinth is women rebelling against male leadership or authority, however you want to take it, within the church at Corinth. And in an act of rebellion and defiance, their hair is to be a covering, whether it's medium length, short length, whatever. But they're shaving it, that's the word they're using, they're shorning it, shaving it, in rebellion to the authority of the guy who's the people in charge who are male. And that's why in verse 10 he says, for this cause ought the woman to have power on her head, the power which is her submissiveness, because of the angels. And the only reference to the angels that could even fit into this are the angels in Genesis chapter 6 that rebelled against God's authority and left heaven. So in the passage, he's making a reference to the women's rebellion against the men's authority, and the angels in Genesis 6 rebelled against God's authority. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. For as the woman is of the man, so is the man also of the woman, but all things are of God. And that's God, what he's saying here. He's surmising this thing, and he's laying it out and showing you that the two have to work together. The woman has to be submissive to the husband within, and when I say that, I don't mean in the doormat mentality, but in the sense that she recognizes that the structure, the head of every man is Christ, the head of man is the woman, and the head of Christ is God. And now, and that's what you got here. And then he says in verse 14, doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? And of course, it's a thing, but if a woman have long hair, it is glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. Now, he's laying it out and showing you that a woman's hair is representing her glory to her husband and him together, verse 11 and 12, when they work together, it gives the glory to his head, which is Christ. But the breakdown here is the fact that they are rebelling, shaving their heads or cutting their hair really short, and it's not the fact that she got a new hairdo that was shorter than the long hair that she had because, you know, every time she went fishing, she caught the fly when she went to cast in her hair. It's not an issue of that. It's an issue of the rebellion in her heart, and I'm cutting my hair as an act of defiance. That's the problem. And, of course, you know, that's what you've got going on here. And then he moves right on down to 17, 18, and 19, and he talks about that there has to be heresies among us. Because heresies will always prove the truth of the Bible because a heresy or a Bible truth has to have two things that make it legitimate. One of them is a record down through history that the church believed it. Two, the record in the Bible that it's biblically sound and taught in the Word of God. So he's laying all that out to these people, and then, you know, he says up here in verse 2, now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances. See that thing? So not only are they having a problem with the women in the church, but they're having a problem with the ordinances. And the two ordinances given to the church are baptism, and they had that problem in chapter 1 and chapter 2 of 1 Corinthians, and the Lord's Supper, which now he picks up in verse 20, and he deals with that issue. So that's how you got that laid out there, Don. Does that help you? Yeah, that's a good question. That's a tricky chapter. If you don't know how to walk through it, it can get you can get really confused on it.
All right, so my question is in Revelation chapter 6.
Revelation 6?
Yes, sir. Verses 1 through 9, I believe.
All right, buddy, hang on, John. We'll get right there. All right, I'll read the first 9 verses here. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard as if it were the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, come and see. And I saw and behold a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and the power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, come and see. And behold, lo, a black horse, And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny. And see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast saying, come and see. And I looked and behold a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword and with hunger and with death and with the beast of the earth. And when it opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held.
All right, so my question is, are the horses and the beasts the same? Like, are those the same thing?
No, the horses and the beasts there, well, it didn't say that they're the same. In verse 2, here's what you got. In verse 2, you have a white horse and a guy riding that white horse. Now, there are two white horse riders in the book of Revelation, and you need to mark that and know that. The first one is in Revelation chapter 6, verse 2. The second one is in Revelation chapter 19, verse 11. In every theological seminary in America, if probably the world, in every theological Bible institute teaching college around the world, they teach you that the white horse rider in Revelation chapter 6 is the Lord Jesus Christ. And the white horse rider in Revelation chapter 6 is the Antichrist. If you compare this rider in verse 2 with the one in 1911, you'll see that they're completely different. And it says, I behold a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth to conquer. Notice he's got a bow, but he has no arrows, meaning he comes in peace. Notice he has a crown, but when the one comes back in 19, he has many crowns. This one comes forth to conquer and conquering and to conquer. So this is the Antichrist, and what follows here is what he brings with him. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, come and see. The beast here are not the horses. The beast here are the, over here, chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. Out of the throne proceedeth lightnings and thunderings and voices, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which were seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was a sea of glass, like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne, round about the throne, were four beasts. Now those four beasts are the cherubims that are around the throne. That's who is over here in chapter 6. They're not the riders, they're not the horse. The horse and the riders are what comes follows is what the Antichrist brings with him. And this is commonly called in the world the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Apocalypse, another word for the book of Revelation. Now the first one it comes in verse 4 represents the war, a red horse. And that's why you have the most wicked, murdering planets or nations on the planet all associated with red. Red China, communism, red. Mars, the great red planet. Mars is the god of war in mythology. The second one that comes down here, I held a black horse. And, of course, the black horse will be famine. And that is the starvation that's going to take place during the last half of the tribulation period. And he says in verse 6, and verse 6 is very interesting, a measure of wheat for a penny and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And that's one of the strangest verses in the Bible till you look around you in the world today, realizing that the oil represents the Arabs or the Muslims, and the wine represents the Roman Catholic Church, and you know would study and figure out the alliance that is taking place right now, and it's going to be in the tribulation period between the Muslims and the Antichrist, Roman Catholic Church. Then verse 8, a pale horse, and of course, that's death. So the beasts here are the cherubims represented that are unleashing these things, but when the Antichrist shows up in verse 2, he brings these horses with him, and you know, that's what you're dealing with. So, all right, well, we'll hold up there. Good questions tonight. Very good. Let's have a word of prayer, and